This reading is number 53, which is to say there's only 53 Sundays every once in a while, so it's not one that we encounter on a regular basis. But Swamiji really sort of packed a lot into these last pages. It would serve us if we saw it every year, but every so often we come across this. The concept that he's talking about of impersonal love and many other things too, which we'll touch on as we go on this morning, is really, I think, one of the most difficult for us to spontaneously understand and to sort of get straight. It's very easy to misunderstand it, but if we can understand it correctly, it's enormously liberating and fulfilling and brings us a great deal of what we really long for in our lives. Many years ago, Swamiji's technique of teaching us over these many years, he rarely will confront someone with their mistakes. He'll rarely confront someone with their failings. He'll just file it away or be very receptive to what you say. But then later on, by his actions, he'll show you more what he means than just by trying to convince us with words. And those of us who use words a lot sometimes think that people can be instructed into wisdom. Having realized that I can't be, it's occurred to me that other people can't either, and that Swamiji has always understood it. I mean, then it's just intellectual. I remember once someone was protesting when he was correcting them on a point or trying to explain something, and the woman said, "I know, I know." He said, "No, you don't. If you did know," he said, "you would be doing it differently." I mean, I just said he doesn't correct directly, but that time he really did. But isn't it often when somebody starts telling us something that we really don't want to hear? How do we block it out? We say, "I know, I know, I know." And we do know. We know the meaning of the words and we believe that it's true. But between what we can intellectualize and what the spontaneous reaction of the samskaras in the chakras, which is how the vibration of our lives is really held and how we really respond to life, there's often this enormous difference. I know recently East West has sold hundreds of copies of this book called The Secret, which also has a DVD that goes with it. And I haven't studied it in depth, and I have no intention of doing so, but I did skim through it. And it's not untrue, but it has a fatal flaw. It's all about the fact that like attract like, and by conscious exercise of the forces, the impersonal forces of magnetism, you can bring into your life whatever you desire. But the gap that's there is the difference between what we think we want and what our souls really want, what our ego desires and what God wants for us, and the fact that merely having ideas about things isn't enough power necessarily to actually change the magnetism in the chakras. The chakras are the storehouse of all of these incarnations of actions, and we build up. It's like just putting pennies into a jar that has multi-levels, and every time we sort of commit ourselves to a particular action or desire, we put a penny right where that is. We put a bit of energy in the chakra that corresponds to that level of consciousness. And over time, some of those chakras get really, really big, and there's lots of energy spinning in them. And no matter how much we say, "I am one with the infinite spirit," or whatever we might be affirming, if by our actions and our responses to life, we're saying, "I am limited, I am afraid, I am insecure." Sometimes people even choose really big affirmations because their real reality is that they're so afraid. And you go too far away from what you really are. You actually, your subconscious fights you continuously. The art of affirmations is very tricky. You have to really believe your affirmation or have real faith in what you're saying. If you say, "I am perfect," then every part of you at the same time says, "No, you're not." You actually end up building the thought that, "No, you're not." If you say, "I am sincere in my desire to realize God," then even your subconscious can say, "Yes, you are." You see how you balance it? But anyway, what I was saying with this is there's this great confusion because the personal part of ourselves that's so involved in all of our thoughts and feelings and actions and desires, it's always in a struggle to trying to validate itself with these higher ideals that we know of what's really true. And this particular subject of impersonal love. Swamiji, at the beginning of Ananda, this has actually happened more in the 80s, when a lot of us had just gotten married and the whole of Ananda was moving more toward couples than toward monasticism. Swami started often speaking about marriage and relationships and what's required for success. And he would often speak, in wedding ceremonies even, about the need for impersonal love. And I thought I had to advise him. It seemed like it was up to me to tell him that this message was not getting through. That the more he spoke of impersonal love, the more people just were confused. What could he possibly mean? And a wedding just really seemed to me, sir, like the last time, the least and worst opportunity to be talking about it. And very respectfully, he just listened to me, and then the next hour started talking again about impersonal love. You know, and I was receptive enough to figure that it probably wasn't his problem, it was probably mine. But I have to admit, it's taken me years and years to understand this, because the ego so longs to be singled out. And what I finally had to reason out, and this is sort of what I'm wanting to try to say to you, we build our faith in God in a step-by-step way. And I was speaking of affirmations, which is a good way to understand it. When you go through scientific healing affirmations or Swami's book, Affirmations for Self-Healing, whatever you're looking at. And I was talking about you need to choose something that you can believe in. You have to stretch yourself, but you have to also believe it. We build our faith, little fragments of it come true to us, and who knows why. When I was looking for an affirmation to deal with certain anxieties I had about when I was trying to write this book about Swami, which I have now done. But there were several years there where I was the labors of Sisyphus. I'd roll paragraphs up the hill and then hit the delete key and then roll more paragraphs up the hill and then hit the delete key. And I could work all day and end up literally with nothing on my screen at the end. It was grim, is the only thing I can say. The only thing that got me through it was that I was the only one who believed I wouldn't be able to write it. The fact that all my friends and Swami kept telling me that I could caused me to doubt my certainty that I couldn't. But anyway, and in the end, it all had a happy ending, and there's a beautiful book. But I had to find an affirmation that I could posit against my anxiety. And I couldn't say something like, you can write this book, because every part of me was saying, ha, 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 I know you can't. It was just one of those karmic periods. So I found this affirmation that said, I know God's power is infinite, and as I am made in his image, I too have the strength to overcome all obstacles. And I analyzed why that one worked for me, because I know God's power is infinite. No part of me could say, no, it's not. God is finite, he's infinite in certain areas. You know, it's just like there was no, that is what Sister Gyanamata described as my solid ground upon which I could stand. And not even my subconscious doubted the existence of God and his infinite nature. The second line, as I am made in his image. Well, I, meaning Asha, we could certainly raise protests against. But philosophically, once again, I'm on solid ground. I understand that this world is a manifestation of God, and that must include me, no matter how flawed I might be. I couldn't really reason that everything was made by God except for me. So I know God's power is infinite, and as I am made in his image, therefore, I too have the strength. I was trapped. Did you see? I was trapped by what I believed in, and it was the lever that was going to remove my doubts. It's a very interesting reality. As I am made in his image, I too have the strength to overcome all obstacles. And no matter how my habit of self-doubt would argue against it, it held me like that. And I mean, I spent a lot of time repeating that affirmation in lieu of letting my mind run in wild, frightened circles. You know, and eventually everything works out. And once everything is done, you know, whatever you went through just disappears. Life is like that. What isn't the now just becomes the dream. And it's so real while it's happening. Swami said the reason people say hell is eternal is because when you're suffering, it feels like it lasts forever. But it isn't, because as soon as it's past. You just wake up from the dream and you're no longer sleeping. Last night I had a really crazy dream having to do with Sunday services and all these things that I do with my life. And somehow or another, we had this combination. I had set up this strange combination where we were turning someone over to the... somebody had done some really terrible things. We were exposing that person and doing something with him, and at the same time we were trying to have an inspiring service. And it occurred to me that these were not compatible things. And so I started on this whole project of how I was going to like put it together, but instead of putting it together, I just got in my car and drove up, started driving away. You know how the subconscious mind is? It's just crazy. And then all of a sudden I realized, in the dream, I realized that I hadn't actually driven away. I just dreamed I'd driven away. And then I stepped back a step and realized that I had dreamed that I was in the whole problem in the first place, and I'm lying in my bed and it's not even Sunday, and oh God, it's just, you know, we're just a total scramble in there. And out of all of that, we have to find these little bits and pieces that are not confused, that are perfectly clear. And what I was coming to with this question of impersonal love, and this was the whole point here, which is, it's very, one of the most fundamental things that a devotee needs is the belief that there is a loving God. And that when everything else is stripped away, that there is a benign, loving force that is in charge of this universe and is specifically in charge of you, in charge of me. And now, if we don't really believe in that, I know God's power is infinite, and that that power is benign, and that power loves me, everything else is a little difficult, and we do need to find places where we can settle into that. Because if we believe that, then everything else that the scriptures and the masters say must also be true, even though from time to time we may feel threatened by it. This is coming all the way back to Swami's constant emphasis, which is something he's emphasized for decades, of the importance of impersonal love. And of course, the biggest problem is just simply understanding what that means. You know, impersonal sounds to us, because of the way the English words are used, maybe there's better words in other languages, it sounds uncaring, doesn't it? A little bit cold. A little bit of, oh, well, that's just their karma, let them suffer. A little bit, if they fall in the ditch, just let them lie there. Kind of questions. You know, I don't want to be impersonal. I want to be warm. And you also think, I don't want to be loved impersonally. I want somebody to love me for me. And when Swami speaks of Christ's impersonal love, you just don't know what to do with that. And then sometimes when people grab a hold of that spiritually, you see how it becomes really unattractive. Many people ask, someone asked Jesus in the Bible, how can you tell a false prophet from a true prophet? It's a very important question, even though we're not walking around looking at lots of different prophets to choose from. What he's actually asking is, how can you tell truth from error? How can you tell true teachings from false teachings? Jesus gives an extremely simple answer. By their fruits, you shall know them. A good tree gives good fruit. A bad tree gives bad fruit. And sometimes we say, you know, if you want to know whether a spiritual teacher that you encounter is someone that you would like to follow, look at those who have followed the teaching. Not just anybody who claims to, but those who have really devoted their life to it. And in them, you will see the fruit of it. And if what you see attracts you, then that's a very good sign that the teaching is true. Swami Kriyananda said when he met Swami Shivananda in India, who's the guru of was the guru of Swami Satchidananda and Venkateshananda and Vishnu Devananda and Chidananda. These are all well-known disciples of this man who's now passed away. Swamiji said when he met him, Shivananda did not make any kind of an impression on him. He didn't feel anything from him. But one of his chief disciples was Swami Chidananda. And Swami Chidananda made such a profound impression on Swami. He seemed like such a fine man with such fine qualities and such clear discrimination and so many other things that Swami felt that if Chidananda could be devoted to Shivananda, then Shivananda must be a great man. You see, sometimes it's very simple. It's not just using this sort of abstract thing. It's something very simple. So Swamiji has always sort of spoken of this impersonal love. And yet, What I have watched through him, with him, through all these years, is this extraordinary individual concern for people on a level of sensitivity, with the capacity to follow through and an awareness of what's really needed, like I've never seen from anyone else, ever. You know, it's just the greatest lover of humanity that I could ever imagine. And he always talks about impersonal. So I just had to realize it just must mean something else. And in our reading today, he talks about that. He talks about Christ saying, love one another as I have loved you. Now, we're not there with Christ, so we have to look at what did Christ do? How did he live? Well, to begin with, you have to say, Christ lived his entire life for the sake of others. Christ had nothing for himself. And in the end, Christ followed his own words when he said toward the end of his life, greater can no love be than this, than a man lay down his life for his friends. That's how Jesus described the crucifixion. He was laying down his life for his friends. And one hears wonderful stories, inspiring stories, sometimes heartbreaking stories, about how people do sacrifice their lives out of love for someone else. You know, that's what a mother does just by becoming pregnant and giving birth. Because immediately, when that child is in the womb, the body prioritizes the child. People used to joke, one tooth for every baby that you give birth to. And what that means is that, well, if there's not enough to go around, then the mother's body is starved and the child's body is fed. And from the father's side, once that child is born, I mean, families are not as traditional as they used to be, but nonetheless, the man has responsibility. It doesn't matter anymore what he prefers to do. All of a sudden, these children have to be fed and clothed and housed, and you know, his life is defined for the rest of his life sometimes, just for that sacrifice. But does it feel like a sacrifice if it's done out of love? No, it's just love. That's that wonderful Indian word, tapasya, which means both austerity and devotion. Because it's discipline, or what appears to be self-sacrifice to others, done out of love. And then where is the contraction? There's no contraction in that word then. Now, the way Christ loved us, the way God loves us as represented by these great masters, including Swamiji, is not for the reasons that we tend to be attracted to each other. Oh, we both like to go skiing. We like the same movies. We were educated in the same schools. She's so pretty. He's so handsome. I like a tall man. You know, with all these different things that people say. Sometimes you hear people describe why they're together and, well, you just wait for the divorce. Because it's too personal. You know, he divorced her because she got fat. And you think, you know, what were they thinking? What is the reality that's in there? And how did Christ love us? There's he loved us for the sake of the divine within us and for the potential of that divinity having full expression. That's what he loved. There's a story in the book that I did, in fact, write. Very simple story. This retreat guest comes up, a man who had just come to Ananda retreat for the first time and was meeting Swami for the first time. And he said to Swamiji, I was standing there when he said it, I heard him say it. He said, I feel more love from you than I feel from my own family. He says, you don't even know me. How is that possible? And Swami answered very simply and honestly. He said, you're right. I don't know you in the way that your family knows you. I don't know your personality and your likes and dislikes and all your preferences. I don't know your history. He said, but I love God. And when I look at you, I see within you that God whom I already love. And that's what I'm loving in you. Now you see how extraordinary that is? You see what that leads to? And that's what, when Swami's talking about impersonal, he's talking about, in almost in a sense, beyond the personal. It's like there is a personality that sort of hangs around that divinity, but it's that divinity that is the enduring reality. Sometimes I've had a very odd experience, and of standing in front of a class or a group of people, and speaking like as I do now. I didn't mean that was the odd experience. The odd experience is coming. But sometimes when I'm meeting someone for the first time, if they're very drawn to master and very drawn to what's happening, or in any way what's happening affects them, there'll be a tremendous magnetism coming out of their face and their eyes, and sometimes a sense of connection between, I feel a connection like we've known each other in some other incarnation, of course, which is obvious. And then afterwards, they'll introduce themselves, and sometimes the personality is so startling to me, because somehow what came across was so entirely different than the costume that the person is wearing. And I'll have to just adjust myself. I don't know whether it's from some other incarnation and when they were different, or it's just the God is wearing a funny disguise through that particular person. And I'm sure you've all had the experience sometimes too. Some people will tell me their names, and I'm certain that's not their name. Just certain. And then some other name will be in your mind. You know, past, that's all past lives more than anything. Or sometimes people are just wearing the wrong name. It has to be fixed later on. But all of those qualities, you know, someone is nice, someone is not nice. Why do we love? What do we love? I remember once something happened, and there was this rumor went around that Swamiji had done something inconsiderate, inappropriate. I no longer have the foggiest idea what the false accusation toward him was. And one of his friends became a little cold to him during that time because of that. She withdrew sort of a step, just kind of became a bit more watchful and a bit less kind. Finally, Swamiji, and I guess I'm contradicting myself, confronted her for that in a very kind way. But he said, "Why have you been so distant?" And she then said something accusatory toward him about whatever this situation was. Swami's answer was very interesting. He just sort of stood back, and he said, well, I don't know exactly how his first remark was, but what he went on to say was, first of all, what a fair-weather friend. You know, that one little bit of trouble and all of a sudden you're withdrawing. And the second, he said, how unkind of you to believe that accusation without asking me. The second thing he said was, if it were true, he said, it would mean that I was really in trouble. And he said, and if I was in trouble, he said, and if you were in trouble, he said, I wouldn't withdraw my friendship. I would offer it to you all the more. Isn't that interesting? But so often our love is so personal that if somebody is pleasing me, then I'll be his friend. If he meets my standard, then I'll be his friend. If it's convenient for me, then I'll be his friend. Because it's the personal in that is not the other person. It's me. It's the one who's giving. And what Swamiji said is impersonal love is that we're very impersonal about ourselves. He said, but very personally concerned about the one that we're loving. You see the difference? When it's personal, it's all about me. It's what I like. It's what I want. It's what my little egoic samskaras say. This is what I have to have. When it's impersonal, it says, I'm going to love you the way Christ loved, which is, what difference does it make? Even whether you're nice. It's just, if you're not nice, you need my love all the more. I had a very peculiar realization at one point with a woman at Ananda Village with whom I did not get along at all. We had an intense personality conflict born from the past. But I realized at one point, even though I didn't like her and I really just couldn't stand to be in her company, she was one of my best friends. Strange realization, because our aspirations were the same, because our ideals were the same. And she was a noble person in her aspiration for God, and she just happened to have what Swami has this beautiful phrase, an unfortunate manner was the way he used it. You know, for someone who's just unbearably obnoxious, an unfortunate manner, he said. Swami can be quite frank. He sees people for what they are. I remember this. There was this person at Ananda once who was very insecure and had a difficult time expressing themselves and was sort of getting a little more strength and beginning to speak out a little. No, actually, she wasn't. But someone said to Swamiji, oh, I wish so-and-so had more confidence in herself and, you know, could speak up more. Swami said, please. He said, it's only her lack of confidence in that personality that makes her bearable at all. He said, if she had confidence and really expressed it, she would just be impossible. I mean, he can be very frank. It's not a naivete. But, you know, he can also say something like that because he would lay down his life even for that woman if it came to it. Because loving as Christ loved. But you see what freedom there is in that? How much time do we spend making lists of what we like and don't like? How much do we suffer because of the way people treat us and what they say and how they ought to? And, you know, just every day is this constant cycle of wishing things different than they were, of lamenting and yearning. Isn't that what the Bhagavad Gita said? The one who sees God in everyone, who feels God's presence everywhere, who knows themselves to be one with the infinite, we don't spend all our time lamenting and yearning. It's just, oh, what a phrase. And however you call it, lamenting is also, I wish they would get it together and do it differently. You know, how often do we do that? We're just lamenting. And then we're yearning, oh, if only. You know, if only I were young again, if only I weren't so skinny, if only I weren't so fat, if I weren't so blonde, if I weren't so dark, if I weren't so male, if I weren't so female. I don't know. We're just always thinking that if things were just different, then I would be happy. But that's not how Christ loved. We have to love this world just exactly as it's given to us, not because we can't see it for what it is, not because we don't devote ourselves to making it a better place, but we're impersonal about it. It's not about us. It's just looking outward and being an instrument. You know, God's love flows into us, God's love flows out of us. We just become that clear window. The window doesn't have an opinion. It's either sunny or it's shady, but whatever is happening, it just flows through it. You know, this is what God is asking of us for a very simple reason. It's our secret of joy, really. There's a benign, loving presence that cares about us. And even though sometimes what the masters say seems contradictory to our ideas of what's going to make us happy, it isn't. It can't be. It never is. Always in the divine and in the divine law is everything we're seeking. This is the last day of this year. And every day, every moment is a new beginning, but more dramatically on a day like today. Let us resolve then to follow the ways of the Lord in all things.